which emit a burst of gravitational waves. Both of these, in theory, could be observed, could already be observed by LIGO. And there are calculations trying to estimate what the rates are like for bursts and for the stochastic background. For the previous LIGO run, there's an upper limit. The range parameter space is very large. There are a lot of uncertainties in these models. But the short version of all this is it is conceivable that LIGO would see gravitational waves from cosmic strings right now or in the near future. And same for LISA. And you can push these limits down. And they get interesting. We should also note that pulsars put a limit and BBN puts a limit. And lots of other ways to also limit the energy in gravitational waves just out there. Stochastic energy, and that would be, in part, from cosmic strings.
What is the basic parameter of the model? Is it just the energy density in cosmic strings, or does
It's a string tension, and then there's also an efficiency for how well they're produced, and then there's also a number for how probable it is for one of them to cut off, and you kind of tune those models. But the basic number is usually expressed in terms of mu of units in string tension. So this is not what I'm going to be talking about, but there could be a talk on this, and it's interesting. So what I am going to talk about is some work I've been doing on what I call standard science. So the other apology here is to people at CETA, because I gave a very similar talk on Monday at CETA. So if you're from CETA and you want to read that, that was a good time, because there won't be all that much that's new between Monday and today. Okay, so here's the basic outline. I'm going to give you a little bit on cosmological background. This is not stuff you really need to know, but it's why this is interesting. And then I'll tell you some about gravitational waves and how that ties in, and then what a standard siren is, and a couple of possible standard sirens. And then I'll wrap up with some comments about gravitational lensing. So that's the game plan. And I'll start with my one side on all the cosmology you need to know, at least as far as this is concerned. And it's basically, you all know this, it's the story for the supernovae, but I'll just remind you, the point is distance, redshift. Luminosity distance versus redshift. Distance tells you how long a photon took, so it's a measure of age. Redshift tells you how big the universe was. So you're just getting the size of the universe as a function of time. That's it. And that's the base observable for cosmology. You really want to measure this. We know how to measure redshifts, but measuring distances is really hard. And so you've all heard the supernova story, where they work very, very hard, spend long hours trying to nail down a supernova as a standard candle. And you do 10 to 15%. Which is really astounding. Okay, now, what I'm going to be talking about is something that does significantly better at measuring distances. And that's essentially the whole point of this talk. So let me start by just motivating why you might think that the gravitational wave regime works for you. Why, in particular, black holes are useful for this. So if you just think about supernovae for a second, supernovae are standard candles. There's a type 1As, they're immensely complex objects. And we don't even really pretend to model them to understand why they're such good standard candles. We just kind of observe a bunch of them and notice that they really seem to be pretty good. But the truth is, we don't really understand what's going on. And when you get right down to it, to truly understand like all the physics involved in a supernova, that's fairly challenging. I don't see that happening anytime soon. And now, let's just go to black holes instead. Black holes are immensely simple objects. They're probably the simplest objects out there. They're really fully described by three numbers. And the truth is, in practice, really all you need to know is the mass for much of what I'm talking about, and maybe the spin, charges involvement. And that fully describes the physics of your system.
But don't they tend to be dragging around immensely complicated accretion disks?
So we'll get to that. But they're trying to drag around. But you would hope that goes away, and I'll talk about that a little later.
It's a mass accretion disk.
Yeah, it's a question of what dominates the space-time, and the masses of the black holes are dominant. So if you just look at one black hole or take a black hole binary, if there's nothing else there, it's fully described by some set of numbers, maybe 10 numbers. And you're describing all of things. Everything there is to know about the system is in this small set of numbers. So that sounds pretty good if you're trying to get some sort of standard unit. And this really is all the physics barring baryons hanging around. So there's a chance that you could use these to do something. Now, when you've got these things far away, so now imagine we have two black holes, or really any two compact objects, and they're pretty far away, and they're orbiting each other, and they're spinning down through gravitational radiation. In that case, it's actually fairly easy to model the system. Spins don't really matter. You can do a post-Newtonian approximation where you basically just say, okay, they're in orbit, it's like a Kepler in orbit, but they're emitting gravitational waves, so they are spinning down slowly, but not that much each orbit, and you can just kind of calculate that out, and you get a very good approximation. You can do better, but as a first pass, this is actually remarkably good. And if you go through that, you find that you get a strain something of this form. So h of t here is the strain. This is the number that you talk about when you talk about gravitational waves. It's what you would observe if you were measuring fractional changes in distance along two perpendicular arms. And you're issued with polarization and various other things, I'm kind of sweeping under the rug, but basically, this is your observable, h of t. And so now, when you have this simple expression for a binary, there are just a few things to note. There's this mass term, which is called the Church mass, which is related to the reduced mass. Here it is. And that is the thing describing your binary. It just tells you the mass of your binary. And then there are a bunch of other things. There's a function of frequencies, which you can calculate. There's a function of angles. So what this is you've got this binary, it's on the sky somewhere, you need to know where, because that impacts what you observe. You need to know how it's oriented compared to your detector. So all this stuff, again, is stuff that you can calculate. And then there's distance.
Can I express my outrage that 1 plus z has been added to the Church mass and not to the distance?
If you would like, I mean, this becomes important in what I'll say. It's a matter of taste, but yes. The point here is that the Church mass is what's called a redshifted Church mass. Yes. It's got a redshift.
Because I was very surprised when you put this up, that the luminosity distance is on the bottom. It shouldn't be the luminosity distance. It should be the luminosity distance down by a factor of 1 plus z. But then, of course, it appears in your chirp.
Well, the reason it's written this way
is infuriating.
No. It's actually the right way to write it if you're doing gravitational wave observations, because you can figure out the redshifted chirp mass from the frequency evolution. And that's what you're actually determining.
No,
and that's the key point. So what you're observing...
Okay, I withdraw my outrage.
All right. So the point here is that when you observe this wave string for a while, what you can do is you can back out everything, calculate, you can back out the Church mass, redshift the Church mass, get that out, and all you're left with is a relation between the amplitude of what you've observed and the distance. Which means that if you do this, you get an absolute measure of luminosity distance. It's not relative. It's not, you've in some sense calibrated it through the physics. It's an absolute measure of distance. And that's, astounding. And so you can just do this. Gravity gives you distance for free. All you have to do is build a detector, observe gravitational waves.
Well, you calibrate the detector. So are there any issues with when you calibrate the detector, you need then to know the distance to one of these so that you can bootstrap
right.
And then,
so
it's still
some,
just a relative measure.
Some issues there. Calibrating the absolute sensitivity is actually reasonably straightforward, so I'm told, by the experimenters. Okay. I mean, it's something that you can...
count fringes. In principle, it's
But
there are some subtleties in the amplitudes, and there are some binary systems that you can use to kind of check to make sure there's a whole loop. But in general, it's not a huge source of uncertainty. That's the expectation. I mean, there is an error there, but it's not major.
I mean, they currently LIGO currently claims to have a specific sensitivity limit, despite it not having seen a source.
Right. So there's some internal way to do that, which.
Yeah, well, I was just wondering if that was good to 1% or 10% or
It's certainly good to 10% because the curves are solid.
Because, I mean, in principle, we can say operate a star is, but we've never done it to better than
3%. So. Right. So there may be some issues there. But you know, that's the real problem right now is just detecting the gravitational wave in the first place. And just to remind you, gravitational waves, the strain you're talking about is on the order of 10 minus 22. And every time you see this number, it should blow your mind. Like, this is not, like, it's absolutely inconceivable how that this can be done at all. And I think for a while, you know, people thought it would never be done. And it's being done now, so it's sort of close.
That depends on what's gravitating and how close it is.
That's right. So this is for sources that you roughly expect. And actually, supermassive binary black holes give strains on that order, and galactic binary black holes also give strains around that order. So this is kind of an estimate of where you think interesting astrophysics starts to happen. So if you want to detect gravitational waves, this is kind of a good benchmark for where you need to be. And that's just you know, what you're doing here is you're measuring a fractional change in distance of 1 part 10 to 22, which is less than a proton on 4 kilometers.
Okay.
It's pretty rare.
Proton. It's not.
No. It's small. Yeah. it's pretty basic. And but it's the amazing thing is that it should be a diagonal lots of sources. Just
out of curiosity, what would, for instance, say a cosmic string kink, let's say just going through our galactic neighborhood, what would that give in terms of a relative? Would it be anywhere comparable to a black hole merger?
So a kink. So I started with a slide that tried to estimate that.
Yeah.
Now I think that's not for the. I actually have no idea how close the nearest one expected. I mean, one really near.
The most optimistic estimate of any possible sources
based on trying to get the most optimistic estimate is around there.
Okay.
Just around there. That's right. I mean, if you take everything, you take the highest string tension, you take the highest efficiency for a formation, all those numbers, you get just the observable region. But actually, you get way above, but then you can cut it out by dBm limits, and that pushes you down, and you end up writing those frequencies. So the point here is it's really hard. Gravitational waves are extremely weak. This is what you need to do. There are lots of sources of noise, but nonetheless.
So Dan, could you just remind me what the dimensionless numbers are that give 10 to the minus 22?
So it's essentially a mass term and a distance term, and there's a c to the fourth, g over c to the fourth, and it's basically what you can name it as it's you can the simplest way to do it is you do the time changing quadrupole of just two masses.
It's like a binary black hole.
So
like 10 to the minus 22 is like the Schwarzschild radius or the distance.
What you're doing is you're taking a quadrupole of that, so you need a time in there. So your masses are on the order of a kilometer, and then you're dividing that by your distance squared, and then you just put in the Gs and Ts and energy.
C in the fourth power in the denominator?
I think it's G over C to the fourth.
They've got to be T's power because they missed on the quarter and quarter. So the regular is one hour C cube gravitational can go on the one.
Yes, but you want in the end, but you want a unit. So whatever works to make it unit for.
So you multiply this.
But it goes in as a distance square as well?
Yeah. Okay, so with all that, the thing now is that we have observatories that are running. Actually, at this very moment, I think that they may be done taking the last science from. So for the last year or year and a half, these observatories have been running pretty much nonstop, observing gravitational waves, but operating at design sensitivity, doing, they want one full year of integrated in-lock observations. So for the last year, LIGO has been running. It's been running at its original design sensitivity, and this is the sort of curve that's been going. So the point here is that this is working now. It's working as designed. Now, there is a caveat that as designed, it wasn't meant to be that interesting yet. It's supposed to get interesting soon, and we can talk about that a little later. But the main thing is that as a proof of principle, it's down now below 10 to the minus 22. Okay, so it's doing what it said it would do. And here, just to show you, the march of progress, just over time, this is the noise, this is what's called the noise curve. This is that dimensionless strain as a function of frequency. And this is what you thought you would be able to do, and the black, the solid line, and the purple shows you what you're actually doing, and you're doing remarkably well. So this has been running now for a while, and it shows that you can actually do this, and it's a good way to practice all your data algorithms. The previous data run, there are a number of papers putting upper limits on those things. This data run is being analyzed now. There may be some somewhat interesting limits. You can rule out mountains on neutron stars of a certain size, but you're not really in a regime where you would. It is conceivable that you'd see something if we get lucky and an asymmetric supernova goes up nearby. LIGO would see it, but overall, there's nothing that's a surefire detection. And the event rates are still pretty low.
So the very closest binary, forget it. I'm not even going to ask.
All right. So this is the current situation. Yep.
What are those spikes that appear at certain frequencies?
Yeah, so many of these, there are a few spikes that are things like 60 hertz, just because all your electronics is running at that, and this is unbelievably sensitive. The way the suspension is done for the test masses, this really is, you kind of suspend this, what's supposed to be a particle at each end that's supposed to be in free fall, and the way that's suspended has certain modes, which leads to resonances. There's a whole series of different ways that noise gets introduced. And a lot of what happens here is you get some spike, and then they just try to figure out what's causing it. Somewhere in the, there's a bunch of servos, there's a whole feedback loop, so it's a very nonlinear system. Sorting out all that. It's very complicated. It's doing something amazing. So it's all in there. So a real signal, so this is actually one thing about gravitational waves, which is not always appreciated. A real signal, you don't see a real signal by eye in pretty much anything. The way a real signal works in LIGO is that buried in this data stream is a periodic signal. It's like a sine wave, but it's slowly evolving, and you pull that out through doing something like match filtering. So signals are not, you just look at the data and something sticks out. Signals are, you do some analysis on the data, and eventually you see what you're looking for, which might make you nervous, but it's not as bad as it sounds. And LISA is not that way. LISA, you do just see signals, depending on the source. So
this is very impressive, though. That bottom line there, you've lost most of the noise spikes.
Yeah,
have a few left.
It's amazing.
It's astounding.
It's what that does, is absolutely.
They're beating the noise. Yeah.
I think in various spots, that's true. So, and just to say, this is what's called, this is LIGO 1, the first version of LIGO. There is a plan, there's always been a plan to upgrade LIGO. And right now, the way that's looking is they're going to do an enhanced LIGO, which will be a factor of 2 that will happen in the next few years. So it's just a factor of 2 in sensitivity. And then eventually there'll be what's called advanced LIGO, which will be another factor of 5, so a factor of 10 overall on this curve. And that's where you start to get very, very custom.
What's the time scale for that?
So enhanced is a couple of years, and advanced is on the order of 2013-14.
Are they releasing the data? Are they going to release the data from these runs?
So there's a pretty complicated process by which the data is
analyze, and I'm not sure what policy is on release to the general public, actually. The data, I mean, one curious thing about the data here is the data, it's a tiny, tiny amount of data. But like, it's just this one, basically, it's one channel just going up and down. I mean, it's really a very...
It's like an EKG.
Yeah. What about all the monitoring data?
No, so that's it. Then there's all this other data, which we need to actually do anything useful. But it's not the sort of, I mean, it's very hard to, you really need to know what you're doing with that stuff to do anything reasonable. So I think there's...
You never release the data until that stuff had all been...
That's not, I would be extreme, I don't think there's any chance anyone's going to release any data until there's a detection.
Oh.
Because they don't want anyone else taking the data and claiming a detection is running out.
I can see that.
So,
Freedom of Information Act.
Good luck.
That's a good question. Is there anything in principle that limits how high you can go in frequency?
Yeah. So on the high frequency end, you're limited by photon statistics. So you have a laser in a cavity, and you're basically monitoring the frame shifts.
That's
it. Okay. Now to go very, very high frequency, you have to have enough photons in that time bin in some sense to resolve that. And your laser isn't bright enough. So you can just put in a brighter laser, which is actually what will happen for enhanced LIGO, and that immediately buys you some. But there's a limit to how much you can do there, because you start putting in a very bright laser, you ablate your mirrors, and then your host. And so you have to have very, very good mirrors, and it gets complicated. But that's it. You don't want heating in your system. The second you have heating, you have thermal noise, and things start to get wiped out. It's actually down here.
And quantum mechanics is this line on this side.
This is actually seismic noise.
Oh, so does delta P, delta X never appear?
It's down in here. And that's actually one of the major issues for the next generation is doing that. And you're going to need to do squeeze states in your detector to have any hope of measuring. So it's you're at such a level that a lot of things are happening. Like that your test mirror, which is kilograms, this test particle, is a quantum system, and that's a problem for you. And it's because you're doing this at it's just technologically. I mean, as I said, this is really it's astounding. It's absolutely astounding.
But in the same sense, telescopes are quantum systems, so it's not impossible.
Just in the sense that there's quantum efficiency,
and they work, and they work at the quantum mechanical limit of how accurately you measure photons.
Yeah.
It's just
this is
huge number of photons.
This is the quantum mechanics of your actual system.
Yeah. That's slightly different, but it's.
Okay. And this is the network, just to kind of clue you in on what's going on with gravitational waves. This is what we have so far. On Earth, it's the two LIGOs. So there are two of them, because you need to be 100% sure that first time you see them that you've really got a signal. Gravitational waves have a whole checkered history, which is a whole other talk. But when gravitational waves are announced here, we're going to be damn sure that they're really there. And there are various ways to do that. There's also a detector in Germany, one in Italy, one in Japan. The German and Japanese one are smaller detectors and are used mainly for technological development, and are extremely useful. Virgo is a sort of LIGO class detector. So there'll be three operating detectors that will, in the coming years, really form the network. And that's how we'll be observing gravitational waves. There's a lot of interest in putting a detector in Western Australia for various reasons. The main one is that it will give you a very good polarization information, which will be extremely useful for stuff that I may get to talk about later in the talk. So that's the basic network model. So in the coming years, you'll hear about Virgo and LIGO. There's also space. So we talked about at the low frequency end, there's the seismic cutoff. On Earth, the Earth moves, it's basically inconceivable that you can detect gravitational waves below this about 1 hertz cutoff. You just can't get to frequencies below that because the Earth is moving and it's shaking everything. So if you want to detect low frequency, you have to go to space. And that's LISA, and that's something that's been proposing.
I heard one caveat to that. I heard a talk by Vuk Mandich about how if you build build a kilometer underground below that.
Then you can get a lot of the gravity gradient noise out. Yeah, so there's this hope. I mean, it's true that if you can build 4 kilometer arms, and there are some sites where you can imagine doing this under a mountain, you actually get, you can get some of that seismic noise out. Just there's a lot of atmospheric noise. Clouds go by and they do stuff. And that matters because you're in this, like, this sensitivity. But I'm not sure how much that buys you. I don't know how atmospheric state people are taking. But it's something to think about. Yeah. Okay. So just to kind of summarize where we're at in gravitational waves, this is the same plot, amplitude versus frequency, and it basically splits into two. There's ground-based detectors on one side, space-based on the other. And it turns out, it just so happens that if you think of the sources on the sky that you're interested in, they pretty much break neatly into these categories where you've got stellar mass things detectable on Earth in a slightly higher frequency regime in the galaxy or nearby, and then you've got sort of cosmological mass, supermassive type objects at the lower frequency at cosmological distances. And so that's the basic approach to gravitational wave astronomy for the coming years. So that's my background on gravitational wave detection. Now I'm going to talk about some sources and why you should care from a cosmological perspective. Okay. All right, so I'm going to first talk about supermassive black hole binaries and LISA. So LISA is a space-based observatory, and its sort of sweet spot, the thing it is in some sense most sensitive to, are supermassive binary black holes on the order of a million solar masses, in spiraling and merging essentially anywhere in the universe. So if LISA is operating and two black holes merge out to 10 or 15, it will see it anywhere in the universe it's all stuck. So, and this is just to give you some, so the range that you're sensitive to is on the order of 10 to the 5 to 10 to the 7 solar masses. LISA would actually observe the in-spiral building up for about a year. And as it orbits the sun, that lets it get some information about the position on the sky of this source. And it lets you do a luminosity distance using this trick that I talked about at the beginning of on the order of 10%, actually somewhat better in many cases. Okay, so just to show you how this works, is you have a binary, supermassive black hole binary on the sky somewhere. LISA sees it. LISA says, I know where it is. So this is what we've done here. This is, I should say, a lot of this work is with my collaborator, Scott Hughes, at MIT. So he and a student made these particular plots. And what we're doing here is we just generate a bunch of binaries on the sky at random, and then ask how well will LISA see them. And this is the distribution of positions on the sky and distances. So positions are on the order of 10 arc minutes, sometimes better. And distances are on the order of 1%, often better. Okay. So LISA, if there's anywhere in the universe there's a supermassive black hole, it'll see it, it'll tell you where it is to on the order of tens of arc minutes, and it'll tell you the distance to on the order of percent.
That's a pretty big box out at redshift 10, right? Yeah, there's a lot of galaxies in that box.
Right.
So how are you going
to
get
to it? I'll get to that. So, but let me first, the main point there is we need a redshift. And so you recall, you can do this, you get this great distance, but you don't have a redshift. And gravity does not give you redshift. Gravity is scale free. So if you think about the way we measure redshift, and this is related actually to a discussion we were having at lunch, you know, there are two theories, there's gravity and quantum mechanics. Quantum mechanics give you scale, it gives you h bar. So there's you can find a line in some spectrum and get a redshift. Gravity has nothing like that until we have quantum gravity. So gravity is totally scale free. There is no way in a gravitational waveform that you could pull out anything and say, aha, there's a redshift. You need to know something about the system. If you know its true intrinsic mass, then you've got yourself a redshift.
But if you don't, all you have is a redshift to trim mass. You don't want a redshift, which means you can't do cosmology with these things. It could be perfect, but you can't do anything with them because you only know distance. Now that's not entirely true. You can kind of infer a distance distribution. You know cosmology somewhat, so you can back out a redshift. So if you want to, for example, know the distribution of binary supermassive mergers in the universe, you could do a pretty good job of that with LISA, just by backing out cosmology, which is something that I wanted to actually talk about, because this has to do with coming up with these mergers. If you have some model for how mergers are happening, that's relevant to how often these things happen. But we'll get to that in a second. The main point here is that if you want to do cosmology, you need a redshift. To get a redshift, you need an electromagnetic helper. So that's a challenge. And that's the big stumbling block in all this, is how do we find an electromagnetic helper?
It's not flying an interferometer in space. That's an AU in size.
that's one way. That would be fine. You could just take a bunch of the smaller guys. Yeah, anyway. Yeah. So we could try to get better resolution that way, or you could just ask, what's the hope of seeing it with something like LISA? So this is my rough estimate of how many galaxies there are in a LISA error box. So LISA says, let's say in the best case, about an arc minute. I know the source is about in this arc minute here. And I know redshift somewhere. Because I know the luminosity distance very well. And I know cosmology roughly, a few percent, 10%. So I get a redshift big where it can be, and I can count up how many galaxies are in that thing. And these are the sorts of numbers you get on the order. The black curve is probably the most relevant. So as a function of redshift, that about redshift 1, they're on the order of 10 galaxies in a LISA box. That's my estimate using, I think, HDF.
What is the redshift bin?
So here the redshift bin is determined by your uncertainty in cosmological parameters. So I'm assuming WMAP extended or Planck era uncertainty in cosmological parameters. Because I'm giving you the distance. So now my uncertainties in cosmology tell you the redshift and the uncertainty in redshift. Okay. So the point here is, if I tell you, I have this binary system and it's out here on the sky at redshift 1, there are only 10 galaxies you have to inspect to figure out which one is the right host. Okay. But in general, the errors will be bigger, so they'll be hundreds or potentially thousands, and it's unclear.
Now, but there might be 1,000 galaxies you have to take redshifts of, so you know which 10.
Which ones fit in
the close enough.
You do a redshift.
It's not easy, and the truth is,
okay.
Even if you only have 10, you need to know the one.
Yeah.
You really want that one.
Yeah.
So,
when you look at the 10 of them, at least the one that looks weird, then you take it.
So one way is. that's actually true. I mean, the point is, this is a binary system. The supermassive binary black holes, chances are that they were in galaxies which merged. So you look to see if there are any evidence of merger. Now, the question is, how long does it take, and how much will the galaxy sell, and who knows? But that is one thing to do. If you look and there's just one system in that box that looks totally weird, that's probably the one. Probably.
Yeah. You said no one knows how long it takes, but is there a range? So how long after the merger?
Yeah.
Is it finally get down?
The problem is that you can calculate that until you get to about 5 seconds and everything goes
through. Right. How long does it take to get to a parsec?
I don't remember. It's like some function of dynamical times. It's on that. You can just think of it as you've now got a point particle in the potential of the whole system itself. However many crossings, something
on that. That gives
it sense. But it's not really common. But the truth. So you can imagine trying to kind of estimate using morphology and whatnot. But what you really want to do is have something go away. Right? You want something to happen that gives you a counterpart. And that's the way, if this is going to work out, that's the way this is going to work out. It's going to be a counterpart of some sort. So the question is, you've got now this system that's merged, and what you want to know is, does it produce a counterpart in the optical? Now, this is a supermassive ion black hole system that's broken. And just to get you oriented, the amount of energy you're talking about is on the order of 10 to the 58, 10 to the 59 ergs. And these are far and away the brightest things in the universe. Gamma ray bursts, and don't hold a candle to this. Like, this is unbelievably bright in the span of minutes and hours. So, you know, the at peak luminosity, it's, I forget, there's some number like it's 1,000 times all the optical starlight in the entire universe for, you know, about 10 minutes. These are very, very, very bright sources, which is why we can detect them across the universe. But that doesn't help you if it's all in gravitational waves. You need some of this to be turned into optical. But you don't need much. You know, an efficiency of 1 part 10 to the 10 would be easily observable by any sort of optical X-ray. So you need, but we don't know. I mean, we don't know what's going on. But any sort of conversion into photons, you would see them.
Isn't it a good bet that these are quasars?
So that's you could. So one idea is, you know, you look in your box. If there's one quasar, that's almost certainly the source. But
I could talk for hours about that one, because people look at, there's very little evidence of binary quasars, which
right.
suggests that maybe when the black holes get close, they shut off.
Right, or maybe, right, or you have to wait, that's right, and then you have to wait.
So it might be that by having quasar rules it out.
Then they emit, you turn them on, so I don't...
Maybe, yeah,
but
it's not necessarily...
But even if that's the case, you don't know how long it takes.
Yeah, and you don't... And so they turn on not from absorbing black holes.
So
you're suggesting that the last moments of the merger would be when all this energy is released
well,
somehow.
Well, it's conceivable. However, you know, without a mechanism, I mean, and so there's this issue, is there a lot of other stuff around? And there is a lot of stuff around. Now, we've got a few million solar masses in black holes in a tiny, tiny region of space-time, so they're not going to actually change the dynamics. So that aspect, you're okay.
What about
but this other stuff can definitely heat up. So there are models where the stuff gets, you know, what all this material is driven onto the larger mass black hole. If that happens, you'd see it. And a lot of the models, the stuff is actually, you know, kind of evacuated, and it sits out there. Some of that star formation happens, so you see the star formation, you see a starburst, and then eventually it falls back about a year later, so you see that. There are lots of models. Like the meanest model, Cyril Finney has been doing this with a student, and it's just a very simple model. It's okay, we have an accretion disk, we have these black holes that have kind of created this large accretion disk around them, the black holes are merging. When they merge, about 5% of the energy, mass energy, is being radiated. So you have a million solar masses, 5% of that is disappearing. So some of your accretion disk is centered on the wrong mass. So the accretion disk, Keplerian disk, is like, well, I get shocks because it's like there's this mass molecule, suddenly the black hole changed mass. And that could generate something, who knows. Truth is, we don't know. So I'm not saying we have a mechanism, you're gonna see a counterpart, this is all set. It's just, basically, anytime you start thinking about it, you can come up with mechanisms that might give your counterpart, but we don't know. So the one way to spin all of this is, you know, if Lisa flies, and there is a supermassive ion black hole somewhere in the universe, Lisa's going to tell you whether or not there's a counterpart. It'll tell you about a day in advance, this is about to happen in this region of the sky, you're going to point everything you've got, and you'll know if there's a counterpart. Now, if there is a counterpart, it gets very, very interesting. So the counterpart does two things for you. First, it gives you a redshift. You just get the redshift of the host or the afterglow or whatever it is. So great, now you can do cosmology. But it also, now you know the precise location on the sky of the source. If you know the precise location, you can now go back and redo the gravitational wave analysis, and you get a much, much better measure of distance. Because if you remember in that expression for strain, there were all these functions of angles that you had to kind of marginalize over. Now, you just know exactly where the source is, your distance gets much, much better. So here's the sort of distribution for distance that you're talking about. And it's on the order of, the vast majority of cases, it's on the order of 10% or better. So you've now got a measure of distance to a 10% of a percent. You know, on this spot, supernova here, or out here somewhere. I mean, it's a perfect distance measure to the very edge of the universe. So it's in some sense the ultimate standard channel.
all you need is, you know, you need the detectors to work and various other things. But Lisa does this. I mean, Lisa just does this. It's not necessarily designed to do this, but it gives you distances. So at this point, what you might think is, well, this is phenomenal, because if you can put even just two or three points at this level onto a luminosity distance redshift curve, you're getting dark energy, you're getting whatever you want to astounding sub-percent. All you need, if you just go through the numbers, three or four of these would absolutely revolutionize the dark energy studies. Okay? But there's one key problem, which Scott likes to phrase as gravity giveth and gravity taketh away. There's one key problem. These are all at high redshift. You're measuring distances. The distances are being length. Right? So any source at high redshift is length. And the lensing, you might say, I know the distance at 10 per percent, but actually the lensing is in, and it's at the order of 5%, sometimes 10%. So the truth is, if I give you a perfect standard candle, there was an alien civilization at redshift 10 that put up a light bulb that we could see, it was perfect. We still would not be able to do basically any cosmology with it. Just one. Because we don't know what the lensing is. So we need to kind of break that degeneracy. So I actually won't go. I spent a lot of time worrying about lensing, and I won't go into that in any detail. If you have questions about it, we can talk about it after. Let me just say that here's the point. You've got this source, you know the distance to it to a fraction of a percent if you could just back out the lensing. So there's just one source, there it is at redshift 1.5. It really would be a perfect distance measure. All you have to do is tell me the lensing to say a percent. So I'll give you all the telescope time you want. Can you tell me lensing along one given line of sight to on your order of percent?
I'm astounded that it matters that much. When you look at the time delay between two images of a quasar or something, they're like a year delay or a billion years or something.
Yeah, so that's a geometric, that's different paths of light.
Yeah.
But the individual images are being magnified or demagnified by a lot more than that order.
Well, yeah, true, but.
And that's a higher order.
It's a lot more than a part of a billion, but. It's really 5 or 10%.
Yeah, 5 or 10%. And it's
how you have to worry about the thing in the supernova.
Yeah, I mean that's the same effect in supernovae. That's right. So the trick with supernovae is that supernovae, you don't know their intrinsic luminosity to better than 10% or 15%.
Yeah.
I mean, so you basically don't have to worry about this. But what turns out is that supernovae are just about as good as you need them to be. Because, if they were much better, then you're starting to make gravitational lensing. Now, there are a few important things about gravitational lensing to keep in mind. It's statistically, it washes out. So if you get enough, if you get thousands of supernovae, for example, it doesn't matter. You can ignore it. There's some subtleties. You have to be careful of what you do. But it averages away. But for one given supernovae, one given perfect standard candle siren, it's a major issue. There are two ways that you can imagine trying to fix it. One is to pick a line of sight and just identify all the galaxies and make a lensing map. People have tried to do that. It's extremely hard. You have to know the shapes of your halos incredibly accurately. It's just not an easy thing to do. You can buy maybe 30% on that. Another way is to try to couple with a weak lensing map. That also doesn't work. You get improvements of on the order of 30%. But you don't get the lensing down to the percent level. So if anyone has any idea about how to measure lensing along any line of sight, I'll give you any telescope time you want.
You're not going to get enough sources to do the averaging, is that right?
Well, so that comes down to the next question, which is how many sources, and that's something that we don't really know. The best estimates are on the order of 100 sources a year to redshift a few. So if you do get 100, on the order of 100 per year, and you get counterparts for all of them, then you start to be competitive with things like SNAP. So here I'm just showing the contours and omega matter equation of state space. And, it's just a standard thing to say. Basically, with on the order of 100 sources,
With MESA, you're comparable to thousands of sources with SNP, because again, these are much better standard channels, and you're just beating down lensing noise. Well, with the supernova, you still have to beat out the supernova noise.
So why are the genetics different?
The genetics are different. There are a number of things. The redshift distribution is slightly different, but the main thing is that these are absolute standard distance measures, not relative. So in essence, you can think of it as Hubble constant built into this.
Same as the Hubble constant.
Yes. And that's an important point here, is that these are absolute distances. You're measuring absolute distance to redshift of 5. It's the same as, you know, running a measuring tape all the way out there. There's no distance ladder, there's none of that stuff. Absolute distance. No calibration, systematics are totally different, generally thought to be under control. It's pretty remarkable.
What happens if capital G varies with time? Capital G does vary with time in a lot of theories.
Yes. So.
And right.
So if big G changes, then you have, in effect, the chirp mass changes. But I think everything else stays the same. So I think you just get the wrong chirp mass.
You believe you get the wrong chirp mass, but you get the correct luminosity distance.
I
mean, it's worth thinking about because actually, in where I live, people talk about G changing all the time. In fact, nobody can imagine it being constant.
I mean, I have to say, I've been done that question before, so I'll have you that much. Yeah, okay.
I mean, we can figure that out.
It's clear that the mass, that your estimated masses will change.
There are limits on this one.
On how much big G will change?
Yeah.
I mean, this is one.
I mean, G changing screws up a lot of stuff, I have to admit.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if there's something in the wave. For example, the question would be, is there something in the waveform that would tell you that G is different? Because that would be interesting.
I assume the answer to that is no, for the same reason,
exactly.
For the reason that you get nothing.
I think it's just a scale. So I think that stays the same. Okay. So So this is potentially very interesting, but a lot of stuff has to happen. LISA has to work. These binaries have to happen at a reasonable event rate. They have to have optical counterparts, which you can find and get redshifts for. Grant Trish wants to be there in the first place. Like, a lot of things have to work for this to actually yield science. But all that being said, if LISA does fly, I think it's extremely likely that you'll see these binary systems merging, and then the only question is, are there counterparts or not? And if there are, then I mean, we're talking, you know, easily comparable to JDA, if there are. Okay. However, LISA is a ways down the road, 2020, if you're optimistic. So just in my last, do I have about 10 minutes? I'm just going to talk about another idea, which is related, but it's for LIGO. Okay, it's the same, you know, basic approach, which is let's just look at binaries, and we'll look at binaries in LIGO. Now, LIGOs, we'll see, okay, so this is, everything I'm going to talk about, we're talking about advanced LIGOs, so LIGO in about 5 to 7 years, that advanced LIGO will see binary systems out to 500 megaparsecs or a gigaparsec, depending on how they're oriented and where they are in the sky. So, definitely cosmologically interesting distances. So you're going to see binaries at that distance, but you have the same problem, which is, will you see a counterpart? And, yeah.
Is the weak lensing less
problem? That's
how much
So when you're talking about these sorts of distances, this is redshifts of on the order of 0.1 or 0.2-ish, and at that level lensing is basically irrelevant for a lot of the way we talk about it. It's sub percent. So what's nice about these systems is, first of all, LIGO will happen. It will see them, you know, and they are out there, we'll see them, and lensing is not an issue. So the real question is just, will there be a counterpart? And
it's noisier? Does that mean, does
it? It is noisier. This does not do it's as good a job for each one. So instead of being each one is a tenth of a percent, each one is a few percent.
So if you get, so you mean they're if you get optical counterparts for both LIGO and LISA, they do comparably well, sort of, in terms of measuring W?
No. So what I was talking about is actually in the luminosity distance directly. So LISA gets luminosity distance to one source to only order of a tenth of a percent. LIGO gets it to a few percent. And so you have to fold that into to how well you can do. LIGO, we'll see sources. And so I'll get to how this all folds in just in a couple minutes. So the basic idea now is, okay, we're going to use LIGO instead of LISA. You're looking at stellar mass binaries. But what's recently happened in the GRB community, if people have followed, is GRBs are now thought to be, I mean, for a long time, there are basically two populations, the short GRBs and long GRBs. The short GRBs now, people are reasonably certain, and who knows, but the general consensus is that they're binary systems. So the thought is, now we have binary systems, these are systems that we've observed, we've seen afterglows, and we can get redshifts for them. So this is a plot of a bunch of GRB systems that have had afterglows associated with the system, and redshifts have been determined. This was actually my first observational paper, and it was pretty depressing because the first few that were seen all had very low redshifts. So the first four short GRBs that they had redshifts for were all on the order of 0.2 or less, 0.25, somewhere in there. So relatively nearby. So it looked like, well, you've got this whole population, and one of these happens every day or every few days, and they're all reasonably nearby. They're all binary systems, and LIGO should basically see them all. But one of the next few that we get redshifts for end up being in higher redshifts on the order of 1, 0.8, 0.4, 0.5. And now it's just kind of confusing. Like we don't really know what the redshift distribution of these are. However, it's not their binary systems. If they're binary systems, like some of these, like this one at 0.161, would definitely be seen by LIGO. So we have a system that's on the sky that is thought to be a binary that would definitely, I mean, it's a surefire thing for LIGO. So if LIGO sees it, you have a redshift from the GRB, and or from the counterpart, and then you've got yourself a distance from LIGO, and you can start playing the exact same game.
Did any of these go off during the LIGO test runs?
Yeah, so a couple of them did, but nothing was seen at LIGO, and that's not surprising because I mean if these redshifts are right, then LIGO right now is nowhere close to this. I mean its sensitivity is going to go up by an order of magnitude, and then it starts getting interesting.
Well, wasn't there one like a couple weeks ago? That some paper came out, like someone their error box overlapped with M31.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Did I read that paper?
They claimed that that if it was an M31 and it was a short duration GRB, it would have seen the gravitational waves, and they didn't. They said it found they had at least 3.5 megaparsecs away, which is further away.
So the people may have the gravitational waves pushed it out, but I don't know if anyone believes.
Or rule out the model that it's a binary.
Hmm? Or it could have been a gamma ray flare from like a nice star.
So you don't. I mean, so in all this again, there are a bunch of caveats. There are a lot of details here, but if they are binaries, then they will be. The typical message, if these are binaries, then we know that LIGO will see.
What's the largest redshift for GRB with the current version? One or something?
No, I think it's significantly higher.
True mass
does. Two? Is it?
For the long, they have one very high.
I'm talking about these guys.
Oh, for this, it's like, I think 1.5 pounds or
something. It's a good, I think
one. So, it's hard to know. I mean, what can be said is that we've seen a few that would be seen by LIGO if they're by this. So again, one thing LIGO will do is tell us,
if we still have something looking for GRBs, one other thing I just mentioned is that what's nice about GRBs is a GRB goes off, you know exactly where it is. So it's very easy to go into the LIGO data stream and pick it up. You know the sky position and you know the time of the event. So that buys you signal to noise, which is part of the reason that you can get out to reasonable ranges looking for these guys. But what LIGO will tell you for sure is if you're still seeing GRBs, if Swift is still up on LIGO, is that advanced sensitivity, it'll tell you whether or not they're biased. Because if you don't see it and you know that it was a redshift 0.1, then it's not a bubble system. So I'm going to end. I can just say, you know, you do one side point is that you might say, well, this is still pretty low redshift. So you're not really measuring cosmology. You're not measuring dark energy. You're not measuring curvature of the luminosity distance redshift curve. What you're really measuring is the Hubble constant. But measuring the Hubble constant combined with CMB gives you actually very good constraints on dark energy. So you do want to measure the Hubble constant accurately. And what these GRBs let you do is with just a few of them on the order of 10, which we know are happening, LIGO will give you the Hubble constant on the order of percent. And again, this is not, there's no distance scale, it's none of that stuff. The absolute measurement of the Hubble constant to about a percent, which is very, very interesting cosmologically. So advanced LIGO could very well contribute, assuming that the GRBs are binary systems. We don't really know, but we'll find out. So the bottom line, gravitational waves are interesting for cosmology, despite what you might have heard. LISO will definitely do some interesting things. LIGO can potentially do some very interesting things. LIGO is running now, and so in the next 5-7 years, there may be some interesting results.
So, are the mergers going to happen? Are they necessarily going to be at rest relative to the galaxy when these things coalesce? So you get the redshift of the galaxy. Could there be like a few hundred kilometers per second?
It's a question of what your model is. So you now have this, you know, million solar mass object, and you can just treat it as one object, and you just want to know where in the potential it will be. And part of that is how long does it take before it actually merges. If you wait long enough, and that's sort of the settling time, then you're clearly okay. We don't know how long that hang-up is. I think people are starting to get some purchase on that. But at this point, I think the assumption is that it takes long enough that it does drop. But we don't really know.
So have those been marginalized over integral?
So the question is, what about spins? You have these black holes, they're spinning, especially in the late stages, that can matter. And so right now we're ignoring that. If you include that, you actually do better, because it gives you higher harmonics on your waveform, and you can use those higher harmonics to infer things about orientation and break some of your degenerates. So spin is a good thing, and it actually improves.
But yeah, you have three parameters.
Yeah, but the extra information you have from there, in the end, you win.
Do the black holes find each other if they're not already escorted to the middle by dynamical friction?
So my assumption is they just kind of settle through dynamical friction until they get close. And then at that point, they dominate the mass. And then they find each other. And then they just eject all the stars nearby. But then, the question is, at that point, what happens? At that point, then, there's not enough material around to drive nothing together. So you need stuff coming in, maybe you need another merger, another black hole comes out.
How optimistic are you about LISO actually 5?
It's gone up. Money's going to be here.
It might be in mini or whatever.
Yeah, so for a while I was pretty pessimistic. So that's part of the reason I started thinking about GRBs and doing totally other things. Just because, in the current climate, it's very hard to see how anything can go this Academy report, which was close to Rank, Lisa, and JDAM, and Connex, was extremely enthusiastic. Lisa, if you read through it, didn't say, hose JDAM, do Lisa first, but it basically said, yeah, we want to do JDAM, but we really want to do Lisa too. And let's try as hard as we can to do both. And there, just the general feedback from the community about Lisa is surprisingly enthusiastic. I think people, because Lisa really is a novel instrument. It's going to do very, very interesting science. Like LIGO, you can have quibbles about, but Lisa, I think it's harder. Like Lisa has guaranteed interesting sources. It'll tell you about, you know, black hole formation. It'll tell you about all these different things you want to know. So it'll test gravity in ways that we can't do otherwise.
But it does depend on a lot of technology.
So if the question is, will it actually work? So there's a lot of uncertainty. Okay, so on that side, and I think the main concern with Lisa about whether it will fly is that it will work. So there's Pathfinder, which is in now 2 years, and Pathfinder is this test machine to test a lot of the inertial systems and various other things that, not the lasers per se, but a bunch of the equipment that will be needed to make Lisa work. And hopefully that'll be successful, and that's sort of the first step. So I think the feeling now is we'll wait till Pathfinder happens. If it's very successful, then you know you can start really thinking about Lisa. If Pathfinder is a disaster, then you've got to go back to the drawing board and roll up with this technology. But the technology is hard enough that you really have to do something like Pathfinder to be sure. And so that's the process. So in a couple of years, there will be a mission specifically to test a lot of the ideas behind this. So we'll know much more.
Thank you.